Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Well, welcome very much. Thank you for being with us tonight here at the LSE. It's great to have you with us at this event that's hosted by the LSE Public Policy Review and LSE Press. I'm Stephanie Ricard. I'm going to be the chair of tonight's discussion. I'm a professor of political economy here at the LSE in the Department of Government. And I'm delighted to be joined by my LSE colleagues, Robert Faulkner, Thomas Sampson, Boram Lee, and I'm particularly delighted to welcome to the LSE Professor Alan Winters. I'll give them a proper introduction in a moment, but first let me just do two housekeeping points. First, of course, please turn off or silence your phone. And second, please know that tonight's event is being recorded. So hopefully in the near future we'll have a podcast so you can refer back to or share with friends or colleagues who are not able to join us today. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions of our speakers. If you're online, joining us online, please put your question in the Q&A box at the bottom. And when you do so, please include your name and your affiliation, just so we know who you are and where you're coming from. If you're here with us in the audience today, I'll let you know when the floor is open for questions. Okay? So tonight's event is to celebrate the launch of a new issue in the LSE Public Policy Review that's focused on international trade. Our title is Trade Under Strain: Policy Challenges in a Fractured World. And so the LSE Public Policy Review is a new open access journal published by LSE Press that focuses on particular issues and does so using a variety of disciplinary points of view. So here on the stage today, we have represented economists, political scientists, political economists, and international relations scholars. And in our issue, there's an even broader range of disciplinary perspectives. And we think that this is really important because you need multiple points of view in order to try to tackle some of today's most difficult problems. And trade has become one of today's really difficult problems. So our issue is about trade, but the LSE Public Policy Review tackles a wide range of issues, for all the way from populism to wellness and many, many more. So please do check out their archives. You can just find them by putting LSE Public Policy Review into your search engine. So this new issue studies and investigates international trade and trade under strain. This is an issue that is now front and center of policy discussions, political discussions, and public discourse. I tell my students that they're so privileged to study trade during a period of time when it's front page news, because for most of our careers, it wasn't. But now it really is front and center of political discussions and public discourse, and so it really is an important topic. It's important in part because it's under strain. The multilateral rules are being contested. The way we traded, the way that we sort of did business as countries and firms crossing national borders is being challenged. And so in the special issue, we wanted to investigate three questions. First, what are the origins of this crisis? How did we get here? Second, how are different countries responding to the crisis in international trade? And third, what does global trade and the multilateral trading system look like going forward? So you'll hear some of the contributions tonight, but please do feel free and to look at the full issue. You can find it just by putting LSE Public Policy Review into your search engine. There's also a QR code outside, and we'll put up a slide with a QR code on it as well that'll take you to the full special issue. For those of you online, there should be a link to the special issue in the Zoom chat. So I am honored to be up here with these esteemed colleagues, so let me just briefly introduce them, starting with Robert Faulkner. He contributed an article in our special issue that is really interesting, focused on geopolitics and tariffs, so I encourage you strongly to read that particular article in our issue. He's a professor of international relations at LSE and serves as the academic dean of the TRIM Global Executive MBA. This is an alliance between LSE, NYU Stern Business School, and HEC Paris, and it's one of the world's leading executive MBA program. His research focuses on global environmental politics, international political economy, and the role of business in international relations. Next, we have Thomas Sampson, who I was honored to co-edit this issue with. It was really a pleasure to work with Thomas. Thomas is an associate professor of economics at the LSE and a member of the Center of Economic Performance. His research focuses on international trade, economic growth, and development. And next, Boram Lee, who wrote a very, very interesting article in our special issue on the electoral logics of trade coalitions. So really digging into the politics of Trade and Trade Coalitions. So I strongly encourage you to read that as well. She's an assistant professor in the Department of International Relations at LSE. Her research examines how value-based issues affect economic globalization, in particular how norms and values travel across borders through trade security policies to shape coalition building, policy credibility, and relationships between states. Super interesting. And last but certainly not least, we are deeply honored and privileged to have Professor L. Alan Winters with us tonight. He is a world-leading expert on all things international trade. He's a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Sussex and is a fellow and founding director of the UK Trade Policy Observatory. He was chief economist at the British government's Department for International Development and previously served as director of the Development Research Group at the World Bank. He also, for many, many years, served as the editor for the World Trade Review. Alan's going to comment on our issue. He's going to give us some sort of questions and feedback and sort of help us think further beyond what we've done in our piece of writing to really question what's going on and better understand trade under strain. So with that, let me start with Robert to kick off our discussion. So thank you, Robert.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, and thanks so much for having me in this group of illustrious scholars in that special issue. I recommend you read it, not just listen to us. And I want to preface my remarks by saying that I approach the issue of trade and tariffs from an international relations perspective. So I don't look at the trade economics behind what's going on in international trade. And I simply wanted to address the puzzle that you've alluded to in your introductory remarks, which is that a good 10 years ago, you wouldn't have really organized a panel on tariffs and trade because tariffs were not an issue. Tariffs had been declining in the industrialized countries thanks to the GATT trade liberalization talks that had been going on since the late 1940s. Yes, there were still higher tariffs in developing countries around the world, but in the core of the global economy, tariffs had become a non-issue. They were really down to really low levels. There were a few remaining disputes about tariffs in a few protected areas, but on the whole, tariffs didn't excite anyone. And then suddenly, 10 years ago, well, you can time it quite precisely, 2016 or 2017, tariffs were everywhere. You open the newspaper today and you get endless stories about new tariffs here, new trade conflicts there, outrage over what's going on in the world of trade. And so there is indeed a big question of, you know, how did this happen? We thought we had solved the problem of tariffs, or at least they were going away, slowly going away, and ever more countries had signed on to the kind of rationality that economists usually preach. So what's happened? Well, I mean, the answer is, of course, 2016. Someone got elected who tweeted in 2018, trade wars are good and easy to win. And that person, of course, is Donald Trump, the US president, currently back in the White House. His first administration started a trade war, raising tariffs, but mainly targeted at China. And it was interesting that that had a very clear economic rationale, right? China was exploiting America, was ripping off America, running a trade surplus with America. The US wanted to redress that. There was talk about bringing back manufacturing, and the trade war was meant to bring about that kind of industrial re-engineering of the global economy. But then, as Trump returned to the White House in 2025, last year, something happened. The trade war became much bigger. Suddenly, tariffs were flying around the world, left, right, and center. It was no longer China. It was now, since the Liberation Day tariffs, over 90 countries that had tariffs slapped on them. Now, the courts are beginning to dismantle some of those tariffs, but the moment the Supreme Court slaps down some of the tariffs, Trump finds another legal basis to issue new tariffs. And so it's an endless game of whack the mole that the American political system is engaged in over whether the current president has the right to impose tariffs as he likes. So what's the difference between Trump 1 and Trump 2? Well, in Trump 1, in the first administration, you could just about argue there was an economic rationale to the tariff war that he started. And I do remember reading some more nationalist, some more interventionist-oriented economists writing that yeah, we don't like trade wars, but you could just about get away with explaining why we need tariffs to rebalance trade relations. This was about the trade imbalances between the US and China. This was about perhaps reshoring manufacturing. It was about protecting national industries that were being sold out to the global market. And so there was a core economic rationale. But then what happened in Trump 2 was quite different. A much more aggressive geopolitical posturing that Trump showed in his approach to tariffs. Right? Brazil was prosecuting the former Brazilian president Bolsonaro. What happens? Trump decides they're going to get 40% tariff increases over and above the 10% tariffs he had already imposed in the Liberation Day tariffs. India refuses to stop buying Russian oil. What do? Slap a tariff on them, 50% in this case. That happened in August 25. The European Union talks about introducing a digital business tax, a digital services tax. What does Trump do? Threaten another trade tariff on top of the one that he's already issued. The BRICS countries held a conversation last year about how they might replace the US dollar and its centrality in international trade. What does Trump do? He threatens trade tariffs. And so on and so forth. Right? Greenland, does anyone remember Greenland? A lot else has happened since January when Greenland was on the agenda. The European Union decided we're not going to pass over that bit of land that Trump demands. And what does he do? He threatens another round of trade tariffs. And so the story goes on and on and on. So how did we get to this point? How did tariffs become a random tool of geopolitical punishing various countries, be they foes or friends? Well, from an international relations perspective, we have basically three ways of explaining what went on. One option is to look at the leaders at the helm of governments that are able to use that tool. Now, to be fair, that's not the preferred way that social scientists think about politics and world history, right? We don't think that the great man theory of history still applies, although perhaps in the wider public that's still a preferred way of thinking about it. But in this case, I have to say, that approach carries a lot of weight because there is perhaps not so much a great man theory of trade, but perhaps a great tariff man theory of trade, because Trump describes himself as the great tariff man. In 2018, so in the first administration that he ran, he tweeted, "I am a tariff man. It will always be the best way to max out our economic power." And while we shouldn't take every tweet at surface value, I think this tweet has some resonance. Because while Trump may be one of the most ideologically flexible politicians in world history, he has moved across the spectrum from the left to the right. He changes his mind on international politics almost on a daily, sometimes on an hourly basis. If there's one piece of public policy opinion that he has held to consistently all those years, going right back to the 1980s when he first made political pronouncements, it's his belief in the power of tariffs as a weapon in the hands of political leaders. So there is indeed a tariff man theory of trade, and that goes a long way to explain what has happened. But then there are two other levels at which we can explain this. We could also look at what's going on at the level of the state or society. We could perhaps ask ourselves, is there popular demand for this kind of eruption of tariff wars that started under Trump? And I think there's plenty of evidence, and we are all familiar with that debate, that the population in the United States, certainly in the US, but also in Europe and in other industrialized countries, has strongly turned against globalization, against free trade ideas, against the idea that we should constantly lower tariffs across the economy. There's good evidence that is supported by election results. There's good evidence supported by public opinion. And I have a feeling Boram is going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And I think it's also clear that it would be difficult to imagine any scenario where, say, Trump hands over the keys to the White House to a Democrat in the next election and the issue of tariffs would just go away. The American public, most certainly, but many other European publics too, won't accept a return to the kind of good old free trade days of the sort of the early 2000s anymore. Tariffs are likely to stay, not least because of public skepticism against globalization, but also public demand for state intervention in managing trade relations. So that is a second factor that drives us into a much higher tariff world in the future. And then there's the level of the international system. And that's the territory that international relations scholars usually go to when they try and explain longer-term trends. And what do we find here? Of course, it's the collapse of the liberal international order that we got used to in the late 20th century and that we are now seeing crumble in front of our eyes. This is about the rising geopolitical tensions between the United States and China. This is about how the US is leading charge against rising powers, not just China, but perhaps others too, and is trying to reorganize the global political economy around issues that reflect growing tensions between these powers. And so we learn from what some of the international relations scholarship on this topic suggests to us, that we're entering a new world of perhaps a second Cold War, a geopolitical rift that will structure global relations between states in a way that hasn't been the case before. And if that analogy to the first Cold War is anything to go by, then we know that trade, open flows of goods and services and capital will suffer. The first Cold War was an era when there were two economic blocs, the Western bloc and the Soviet-controlled economic bloc, and the two blocs were trying to kind of reach a stable stalemate in their relations, but they never fully integrated. For that, we had to wait for the end of the Cold War. Now, to be sure, the Second Cold War is going to be conducted in a very different context, because unlike the US and the Soviet Union, the US and China are much more heavily integrated economically. So we're not going to get to the same level of economic decoupling and disintegration as we did between the Soviet Union and the United States. But the tendency that kind of geopolitical structuring of international relations dictates is clear. The tendency will be towards some form of decoupling, higher trade barriers, much more conflictual relationship in which tariffs will play that role of geopolitical leverage that the US is seeking, and we will see how far that can go. The prediction, therefore, is quite clear for the reasons I've given: individual leaders, state and societal trends and geopolitical structure. We're going to end up with higher tariffs, more trade disruption, and more use of trade policy for geopolitical reasons. So my argument in a nutshell, and I'm going to conclude there, we are looking at a profound transformation in the use of tariffs. What used to be just an economic tool and a tool of industrial policy is now a kind of an instrument of choice for geopolitical pressure. That's not going to go away. As far as geopolitical tools go, however, there are not that many countries that can use them effectively. That's reserved for great powers, for the leading powers. And so we're going to see a big gap opening between those countries that can actually use tariffs for geopolitical purposes and those that can't. And that raises the question, what should those lesser powers, countries like, well, dare I say, the United Kingdom, dare I say, some other European countries, some emerging economies, particularly developing countries, of course, but certainly the middle powers that Mark Carney spoke about recently in Davos, what should they do about this? Well, the bleak future for them is you haven't got that much leverage in a trade conflict. And the response that they've put up so far against Trump's use and abuse of tariffs is interesting. Apart from China, very few other countries have retaliated or have tried to weaponize tariffs in the same geopolitical way. And so it seems to me that developing this kind of geopolitical response to American tariff aggression will prove very difficult. What Carney has started in terms of thinking about the geopolitical rupture and how we could all respond as middle powers will prove very difficult. Coordinating a response will be difficult. A more likely scenario, I would argue, is that middle powers will have to diversify away from exposure to trade dependence on the United States. That's not going to happen overnight. It's a gradual process, but it's starting to happen, and that may well prove that even for superpowers, using tariffs as a geopolitical weapon may be counterproductive in the long run. It's just that your allies and your foes will try to find alternative trade partners, and that will in the end lessen the strength of your geopolitical instrument called tariffs. I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert. You gave us a really rich set of ideas to start with, thinking about the individual, the national, and the international level. Thank you very much. We're now going to shift from an IR perspective to an economist perspective with Thomas. Thanks.
Thank you, Stephanie. So I just wanted to kind of say a few brief words about what actually changed in US trade policy in 2025, and what do we know so far about the impacts, and I'm going to focus particularly on the economic impacts of those changes in US trade policy. So the first thing to say is that, you know, simply looking at the numbers, the changes in US tariffs last year during 2025 were unprecedented in the, both the scope of the changes and the extent of the tariff increases. At the start of 2025, the average tariff on US imports was about 5%. So even after the wave of tariffs that were introduced during the first Trump administration in 2018, average tariffs were still in the kind of low single digits. Fast forward 12 months, by December 2025, that number had increased from 5% to roughly 20%. So that's a four-fold increase in average tariffs during the course of the year. And it's taken US tariff levels back to levels that we haven't seen since the interwar period, since the kind of trade wars that occurred during the 1930s. And, you know, Robert spoke during his remarks about the gradual decline in tariffs that had occurred under GATT and under WTO. So we get to this point where kind of tariffs didn't matter anymore, right? That was kind of 50 years of tariff declines, and it's basically been undone, at least from a US perspective, in a single year. Right? So it's not just noise about US tariff policy. There genuinely have been unprecedented increase in tariffs that occurred last year. And then I want to make three observations about what impact these changes in tariffs have had. Now, obviously, the kind of research and the studies that people are writing on these tariff changes, they're just getting started. So we don't know everything yet about even the short-run impacts of these tariffs. But we are starting to kind of get the evidence and to have a sense of how these tariffs have changed, in particular, kind of how they have affected US trade. So, first observation. What's happened to US imports as a result of the tariff increases? Well, as you would expect, higher tariffs increase the cost of imports from a US perspective, and that has reduced US imports. And if you look across countries and products, the areas where tariffs have gone up by more is where we've seen bigger drops in trade. So, you know, that's as you would expect, but it's kind of reassuring to see that that's what shows up in the data. A more interesting question is what we see when we split the drop in US imports into what's happened to the quantity of imports versus the price the US pays for imports. And what we see when we make that division is that almost all, maybe 90%, maybe 100%, we're not quite sure yet, but almost all that drop in imports is due to the US buying a lower quantity of imports. And, you know, at most 10% of that drop is due to the US paying a lower price for imports. Right? Now, that may sound like a somewhat technical division, but the reason I want to highlight it is that it's really informative for thinking about who bears the burden of the tariffs. Right? It's because one possibility is the US imposes tariffs, and foreign exporters respond by reducing the price that they charge to the US. And in that case, it's the foreign exporters who are bearing the burden. Another alternative is foreign export prices are unchanged, and the costs of the tariff in that case are borne by US importers and US consumers. And what the data is showing us is that perhaps all, perhaps close to all, of that burden of the tariffs is being borne by the US importers. So in that sense, what the kind of early data is suggesting is that this is really an act of self-harm from the US perspective. It hasn't driven down foreign prices. It's just increased the cost from a US perspective. So that's the first observation I wanted to make. Second observation, right? What we saw last year was not just a big increase in tariffs, but it was an extremely chaotic episode of trade policy making. Tariffs went up, they came back down again, they were delayed, they were reinstated. Sometimes one tariff stacked on top of another, sometimes it didn't. Right? This was most clear in the Liberation Day tariffs, which were introduced, then immediately postponed. They came back in a different form late in August. Right? So rather than having a simple once and for all increase in tariffs, we have had this sort of, and I think this really isn't something, certainly in my experience, we have seen previously. We have just seen a lot of confusion about what was actually going on with US policy making at any point in time. And some recent work I have been doing, we've tried to estimate what the impact of that confusion was on US imports. And what we show in that work is that the confusion, and in particular, you know, what we think this is US importers and foreign exporters potentially not fully understanding what the tariff level they face at a given point in time is. So they're just failing to fully understand the state of policy at a moment in time. That this confusion has itself further reduced US imports beyond the simple effect of the tariff increases. So there's this additional effect, additional trade disruption coming from the confusion. And the way we kind of see that in the data is if you look at countries and products where there have been more trade announcements, or where the gap between announced tariffs and actually implemented tariffs is larger, those particular kind of import flows have declined more than our import flows that face the same tariff increases, but through fewer announcements, or through announcements where the gap between the implemented and the announced tariff was smaller. So I think this is interesting because, you know, one aspect of the 2025 tariffs that has received a lot of attention is the unusual way it has been implemented. Right? And there's been a lot of anecdotes about businesses struggling to keep up with what tariff policy is. But then a question for researchers is, okay, is this just kind of anecdotal and interesting but doesn't fundamentally matter for understanding the substantive effects of the tariffs? Or has the way in which the policy was implemented driven its effects? And what this evidence is suggesting is that the fact that there was this confusion over tariffs has mattered for the level of trade disruption we've seen. And what our estimates suggest is that the decline in US imports in 2025 was twice as big because of the tariff confusion as it would have been if the announcement had just been a kind of one-off tariff increase, which was kind of simply presented and easy to understand. So this provides a kind of piece of evidence that the way trade policy is implemented matters above and beyond what the actual trade policy changes are. Okay, so that was the second observation. And then a quick third observation is, what do we know about whether the tariffs have actually achieved their stated aims? Now, this is a bit of a difficult question to answer because it's not totally clear what the stated aims of the tariffs were, or at least the stated aim depends on the day you ask the question. But what we can say is, you know, if the aim was to raise revenue, job done, right? US tariff revenue collection in 2025 was about $260 billion, and that was more than three times greater than it was in 2024. Now, some of that revenue might now be being refunded after the Supreme Court invalidated the IEEPA tariffs. But it is certainly true that there has been a large jump up in tariff revenue collected by the US government. Another, you know, motivation for the tariffs has been to decouple the US and Chinese economies. Right? Now, this was more clear in the 2018 tariffs, which more specifically targeted China, and the 2025 tariffs obviously have been more broad-based. But if the goal is to reduce trade between US and China, again, that is something that has clearly happened through the course of 2025. At the same time, lots of other motivations have been put forward for the tariffs. Reducing trade deficits, promoting manufacturing jobs in the US, shifting US trade patterns to be aligned, better aligned with US allies. On all those fronts, you know, either the tariffs haven't succeeded, or we don't have any evidence yet that they have kind of achieved those goals, right? In particular, the US trade deficit has not closed as a result of these tariffs. There hasn't been a manufacturing renaissance in the US. And if you look at how the US tariffs have been targeted, you know, traditional allies like the UK, for example, have borne the brunt of these tariffs as much as what you might consider kind of geopolitical adversaries of the US. So it's very hard to see a pattern in these tariffs that suggests they have really been kind of geopolitically targeted. So I will stop there. Thank you.
Thomas, thank you very much. It's really important to have good, careful empirical work identifying the effects of these tariffs, because if tariffs are here to stay, as Robert has argued, then this is giving us a peek into the future about what they're going to look like. So Thomas has given us really good evidence that these tariffs are a form of self-harm. Right? They're hurting U.S. importers and ultimately, I'm going to extrapolate here, U.S. consumers. And the question then is why? Why would you do an own goal? Why would you self-harm? And I would say the answer is politics. And so Borm is going to illuminate us on the politics behind trade and trade coalition. So switching now to the politics, Borm.
Thank you, Stephanie. A lot of pressure. So I work at the intersection of international relations and political science. So I'd like to start with a question that a lot of trade policymakers might be thinking right now. How do we build a pro-trade coalition, especially in your legislature? You might say this is not a relevant question in the U.S. context right now, but again, even within the U.S., where the Trump administration largely bypassed Congress, there will be the first joint review of the USMCA in 6 weeks. So in that case, if you are the USTR or a trade negotiator within the U.S. government, what you might be thinking right now is, how can I really rally support from the Congress if there will be any revision of the USMCA in major ways? In that case, any revision might have to gain support from Congress because it'll require enacting an implementation bill. So I focus on a specific strategy that a lot of international relations scholars studied, which they call issue linkage. And issue linkage is where a trade negotiator brings in a non-trade issues into trade negotiations. And the goal is quite simple and intuitive. If you're the chief negotiator of your country, you don't have enough votes to pass a liberalizing trade agreement in your legislature. What do? You attach other non-trade issues that your voters care about, such as the environment, health standards, workers' rights, or the flows of fentanyl in the US case recently. And the logic is, if you bring in those non-trade issues into trade negotiations, your trading partners are likely to accept to give you concessions in those issue areas because you really want to get access to the lucrative US market. At the same time, your domestic audience will now become more favorable to this trade agreement, although previously they were indifferent or opposed to this trade agreement. But then now they start seeing this trade agreement as a vehicle to promote their own issues, such as environment or health. So in that way, this issue linkage strategy is designed to facilitate this quid pro quo at the international level and the domestic level. And the US government has been using this strategy quite proactively in the past, many years, but I focus on the Clinton administration where the issue linkage strategy genuinely shined. So the Bush administration negotiated this deal, but it was under the Clinton administration where the NAFTA was put to vote in the House and the Senate. So Clinton secured two-side agreements mainly in labor and the environment. And the hope was that he was faced with severe opposition from major unions like the AFL-CIO, the United Auto Workers, and environmental groups. With the securing of the side agreement, his administration was hoping to boost support from legislators who cared about labor rights and who cared about environmental issues. And the NAFTA, I mean, even when he did secure these historic side agreements, NAFTA passed only barely in the House. They gained 234 votes in support of NAFTA, and there were 200 votes in opposition to NAFTA. So think about it this way. If these 34 members of the House of Representatives actually opposed the NAFTA in 1993, NAFTA wouldn't have existed, and the history of global economic globalization would have looked very different today. So does that mean that issue linkage strategy worked to sway these 34 members of the House? Or not? So one of my research looks into whether these side agreements actually affected the positions of members of the House in 1993. So there are two contending hypotheses in the literature of international political economy, and there are two ways to think about this question. First is what people would call disguised protectionism hypothesis. And these scholars would argue, actually, this kind of issue linkage will sway legislators who represent import competing districts, because there will be a lot of losers of economic liberalization in those districts. Those legislators expect to use these side agreements in environment and in labor as non-tariff barriers to protect those losers of economic liberalization. And the other hypothesis, what I would call and what others would call a fair trade hypothesis, is no, it's not about economics. These side agreements genuinely recruit members who care about those issues, like labor rights or the environment, and it'll change their positions on NAFTA because they will see the side agreements as a political opportunity to promote their issues. And in my research, I find little evidence in support of the protectionism hypothesis. In fact, members of the House who represented import competing districts were not likely to become more favorable as these side agreements were concluded. But by contrast, people who cared about the environment and labor, they have become genuinely more favorable to NAFTA as these side agreements were negotiated. But here's an important caveat. Not all of them supported NAFTA. Only a half of them became more favorable to NAFTA because of the environmental side agreement. And who are those people? And my research finds that they represent, disproportionately, they represent competitive electoral districts. And the logic is they are usually cross-pressured between pro-trade businesses and pro-environment voters. So they don't know what to do about NAFTA. They want to support it in support of the pro-trade businesses, but they can't really support it without any political cover because of environmental voters. But these side agreements give them some political cover, and they can go to their environmental voters and tell the story, hey, I just didn't support NAFTA just because of trade benefits. I did it for the environment as well. So my research shows that issue linkage is the key requirement for issue linkage in expanding trade coalitions is through electoral incentives. If these legislators did not have those electoral incentives to change their positions, then issue linkages may not have actually swayed some legislators who were conflicted about NAFTA. And now you might be thinking, why should we think about 1993 NAFTA? Like, I mean, times have changed, and now we're like living in a very different time period politically. Especially the Trump administration doesn't really care about Congress. It bypassed Congress in many trade policies that the administration has enacted. But then I would still say that issue linkage can be more important this year, especially facing the midterm election and facing the joint review of USMCA. The Trump administration has tried to link a lot of different issues this year and the past year. The flows of fentanyl, immigration, even the regional continental defense is now considered as an issue in the USMCA joint review. Would these issue linkage rhetorics meaningfully sway members of Congress in support of Trump's trade policy agenda? Maybe if you're really loyalist Trump supporter in Congress, maybe these kinds of rhetorical devices may not matter. You'll support his trade policy, whatever the government does, the executive branch does. But then, what about Republicans representing more diverse districts where they are faced with pro-trade businesses, but also the more loyalist Trump supporters and environmental voters? So will those members of Congress actually change their positions because of this kind of rhetorical devices? And what about Democrats? They have been pushing for these kinds of issue linkages for a long time, and then it hasn't really succeeded. I mean, given the Biden's failure to pass the trade pillar in the IPEF, etc. So my research argues that maybe the implication of my research is that trade policymakers have to think more carefully about how to pair up more creditable issue linkages for members of Congress and incumbents. For example, Democrats can no longer go to their district and say that I supported the trade agreement because of the strong labor chapter in the USMCA. That may not have anything to do with people who live in their small district in Ohio. So the executive should give them some excludable benefits where legislators can claim credit for. And that kind of policy has been discussed among economists and political economists, like regional incentives, some commentators might call pork barrel politics in a very derogative way. But then what's wrong with pork barrel politics if it actually enhances the public welfare at the expense of some costs that are diverted to people who might oppose trade liberalization? And also, we might want to think about how the cost of building this kind of coalition with issue linkage. So my final point is that, so issue linkage made sense when the US politics was less polarized. There were people, voters, who would vote on certain policy issues. So I care about the environment, that's why I would vote for the Democrats. I would vote for human rights, so I support my Democratic candidate. But that kind of voting pattern is no longer prevalent in the US politics right now. It's much more polarized along the party lines. And so in that kind of new polarized environment, maybe this kind of issue-based issue linkage strategy might not really meaningfully sway a lot of legislators in Congress who might have to appeal to this kind of nationalistic and patriotic rhetoric. So I'll conclude here.
Thank you very much, Borm. Borm, whenever I read your research on issue linkages, I always am reminded of this flipping comment that I've heard several times in Westminster, which is trade agreements are not Christmas trees. Right? It's a sort of pushback, like you can't just attach your pet issue to trade agreements. So it makes me think that your research on this topic generalizes beyond the United States, perhaps to the United Kingdom and others. So thank you very much. Last but certainly not least, we have Professor L. Alan Winters, and he really is the perfect discussant for us today because the LSE Public Policy Review is intended to bring rigorous academic research to audiences that are interested in policy. And Alan has mastered this trick of bringing rigorous academic research to policymakers and to influencing and impacting policy. So we couldn't ask for a better discussion today. So thank you very much, Alan.
Thank you, Stephanie. I'm not sure I can live up to all of that. Stephanie made the point, this is a hugely important issue, and the editors have collected up a very interesting set of papers. I, in 8 minutes, don't want to try and sort of sketch up a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And so I want to talk about sort of, I guess, sort of one thing that struck me arising really from the political economy papers. I'm an economist, so I'm already out of my depth, and perhaps, maybe I would have been better advised to talk about Tom's presentation, but I'm not going to. The question is really, policy challenges in a fractured world, why is it fractured? I mean, yeah, what's behind that? And I think that there are three papers in this issue which sort of contribute to that and almost add up to a narrative. They include the two papers that Robert and Borum have presented, but also the paper by Jeff Frieden, who's a very distinguished commentator on these things. So let me start off. I hope I want to try and sort of spin this into a single story, if it's possible, and Borum and Robert can put me right. I'm bound to misrepresent you. Jeff Frieden's thesis is basically, we have norms, we have rules that are sort of set up expectations among countries or people about how others will behave. And that leads to standards of behaviour, and that collectively is basically what represents a regime. And the regimes start to fall apart when those expectations are fractured, when they are violated. And that indeed is certainly where we are at now. One could not, I think, have lived through 2025 without believing that our views of the norms of international relations, international diplomacy, are being violated substantively, but stylistically, verbally, in almost every way you can imagine. What happens? What's behind these violations? And Jeff makes the point that we arguably are seeing the decline, possibly the end days of the second big round of globalization. The first was the late 19th century. And why did that fracture into the chaos of the 20s and 30s? And his argument is really it was the widening of the franchise and the way in which governments had to essentially engage the enthusiasm of all sorts of sectors of society that up to then had never really counted at all in the policy process. Come to the end of the war, and these people basically said, hey, you used to ask us, when you really needed us, you asked us, now you've got to ask us again. And that essentially led to pressures on governments to break the system that we had had in the prior to the First World War. The solution to this grew out of the Second World War with an extraordinary period of cooperation. Essentially, the cooperation under a hegemon. And the hegemon was the United States. You all know that. And what we've seen over the last 50 years or so is the hegemon has rather cooled on this. And one can essentially ask why that should be. There's very interesting work by Aditya Mattu and Rob Steger from an economist's point of view, which basically says, look, when you're the hegemon, having a system is very attractive. You actually can reap a lot from all that's going on. Nobody will play with you if you don't constrain your own power. So you constrain your own power and you have a regime. And basically the hegemon enforces the rules It's biased for sure, but then nonetheless it is, in a sense, orderly. But as the hegemon becomes a smaller fraction of the world economy, the benefits from running the regime relative to the costs of running the regime begin to decline. And eventually, the hegemon loses interest. And what we've seen really over 40 years in America is a gradual disenchantment with public disenchantment with trade, and that there's been a political response. It's been quite muted at times, but essentially I would put that in the terms of, if you're a hegemon, you dominate nearly every activity in the world. And of course, as other people develop, some of those areas that you dominate, you are no longer going to be able to dominate. And the people who are dominant in things tend to want to protect their interests. So it's essentially a sort of loss of competitiveness in traditional sectors that does sort of press the US into losing interest. And we've had this gradual erosion, and then it all came to a head with a sort of sudden explosion under Trump. That's the Friedman paper, at least my interpretation of the Friedman paper. Now, Robert's paper has layered on top of that a very specific rivalry between the US and China. And I think basically argued that, this is inevitably going to raise frictions. I was reminded very much of Graham Allison's book on Destined for War, the Thucydides Trap, which I did actually tweet before President Xi started talking about it, but Thucydides is on all our lips these days. It's a great disappointment to me that we weren't here last week. I could show my learnedness. But basically what this has done is bring into the sort of Frieden narrative a very, very specific bit of geopolitics sort of layered on top. And gradually we've got into a situation where we've become more and more concerned about national and economic security, and that in a sense the overt and understood benefits in the public of the economics of the regime have gradually faded behind the sort of more exciting and worries about security of one sort or another. And then the other thing that Robert brings into it is Trump, the man. And he made, as he said, a sort of slightly unfashionable point that here is someone who is consequential, and maybe we have to recognize that Trump has had a unique effect and probably a lasting one. But it's important to remember that Tariff Man was empowered by public attitudes. The public was ready for this. It was not that Trump turned public attitudes around. I think he more likely exploited it. Now, I've got a question that maybe Robert can sort of shed light on. I mean, is the Trump-like revolution inevitable? Or was it something that if we hadn't had Trump, a sort of more enlightened, gradual reform of the system would have addressed the worst of these frictions? And indeed, we would not have had a year of possibly total destruction of the system, but certainly very dramatic weakening of the system. So now, let me move on to Boren's paper. And that she's sort of underpinned this, gone back into sort of voting patterns, what people happen to care about, and, pardon me, into the legislature. I think she noted, Robert noted, who cares about the legislature these days? I mean, to hell with her, they hardly care. But maybe we'll get over that. And essentially her story is that it's become much, much less easy, more difficult, maybe impossible, to create pro-trade coalitions. And the shorthand version of, I think, what she's writing is that essentially trade policy or other activities in the public sphere become basically tribalized. Your tribe matters. And that takes precedent over any analysis or reading that you might ever have done about policy. It's the tribe. And then second to the tribe, and she's very explicit about this, is pork. Namely, we give excludable specific benefits to particular interests that we need to buy across. I happen to think there's quite a lot wrong with pork, actually. I mean, and essentially the problem is that the things that the pork is spent on are of very little benefit to almost anyone. And so that essentially it's essentially a way of generating very bridges to nowhere, that sort of thing. But it seems to me that this story that Oram has given us underpins sort of the, I suppose, the way the public and then through them to the legislature has worked behind the sort of Frieden and also Roberts argument. I think that this notion that that economic and national security are the most important things is something that is very easy to slip into when you take for granted that there is an economic system that delivers all the benefits that we're used to. But when that becomes threatened, suddenly you find economic outcomes of the sort that Tom was talking about come up the pecking order of what determines your view on an issue. And I think, an interesting example, we just relaxed the restrictions on Russian oil. Now, if Britain had a foreign policy objective, Ukraine was very high up, but no, 5 pence on the price of petrol. No, we'll do the economics, we won't do the politics. That writ large is, I think, what we might find, and if we manage to crash the world economy, go back to the 1930s, it is what we will find. Now, I've also got a question for Boram, specifically, which is sort of where did this partisanship come from? I have views about this. I think it stems partly because we have just taken the economy for granted. It just ticks along, it's there. Every day of the week it's there, and they talk on the radio about it's 0.5% up or it's 0.5% down, good or bad, but it doesn't make that much odds. And so we don't, as it were, internalise that this is a system we have to care for, nurture. I also happen to think I'm old enough to say this, social media. I think the declining attention span, lack of analysis, the echo chamber actually has gone a long way to making policy choices, policy voting, much more difficult. Now, just to conclude, I've got a question for everyone, really, and this includes everybody out there as well. And it really is, where do we go from here? Roberts observed that only a few countries can use tariffs, and I think there's a very interesting thing going on. But I think a year ago, a lot of us were worried that Trump would actually cause everybody else to start fighting. But in fact, trade among other countries, the middle powers, has stayed pretty robust. And the policy has stayed, there have been some unfortunate things that irritate me immensely as someone who spent a lifetime worrying about trade, but actually aren't totally fundamental. But I think the question is, have we got any clear policy prescriptions? And to go back to sort of the possibly the most sensitive issue at the moment, the Thucydides trap, I mean, Graham Allison, his prescription was be realistic. Governments just need to be clear what is the situation. They need to recognise where it's come from, i.e. recognise some history. To be strategically clear, can you imagine that in Washington? And to think hard about options, and I would add to that, be honest about the options. And I think the question, in a sense, is, are we also traumatised by what we've seen in the last few months, that we're sort of giving up on the feasibility of this, or is it something that we can restore? It's bigger than trade, but trade is really at the apex of this concern. It's obvious, it's quite important, and it's subtle that people don't immediately understand. So, thank you.
Alan, thank you very much. You gave us a lot to think about there. Get your questions ready. I'm almost going to come to you, but first I'm going to give our panelists a chance to respond to Alan. But please have your questions ready, and I will come to you shortly. But I'll start first with Robert. Do you want to respond to Alan?
Yes, thank you. Alan, fantastic remarks, and I agree with you entirely on the big story that you told us about where we've come from and what we've lost. Your question was, would trade policy have worked out differently had Trump not appeared on the scene? And I think there are three ways in which it would have been different. We would have had a less extreme type of trade war. We would have had a less chaotic use of tariffs. As Thomas explained, it's been extremely chaotic. And it would have been more targeted at China by the US, which is surprisingly, of course, the case with Trump's lack of strategic focus. He just cannot, if you accept the premise that the US needs to try and contain or reduce the rise of China, he just cannot focus on the job at hand. He's always looking for a deal, he's always distracted, and he will move in mysterious ways. He will trade in whatever it takes to get the next deal over the line, and that doesn't make for a clear trade strategy. So I think we would have had a different kind of a trade conflict, but I think, as I try to argue, for geopolitical reasons, we've moved from a world where we accepted that we are in a positive-sum game in trade. We moved to a world where everyone thinks we're in a zero-sum game. We moved from a world where powers coexist to a world where powers intensely compete. And I think that's got little to do with Trump, and for that reason, I think the direction of travel would have been the same.
Thanks, Robert. Thomas, do you want to tackle the where do we go from here question?
Thank you for the easy question. Obviously, I can't kind of answer that question in the round, but maybe I can give a UK-specific answer to it, which is that I think for a kind of middle power and like the UK, which has a very open economy that is very reliant on its trade relationships with a number of other countries, preserving the benefits of the kind of rule-based trading system that have started to erode during Trump's terms in office is an important objective. I think countries like the UK benefit a lot from a trading system that is not governed by the powerful do whatever they want, but is governed by rules, and therefore the UK should be looking for ways to preserve that system as much as possible. Now, obviously the UK is not in a position to directly influence what happens in Washington either under this administration or if there is a change in government. But as Alan mentioned, one of the positive developments in trade over the past year has been that, except in their relationship with the US, countries have mainly stuck to the existing rules and tried to kind of abide by their trade agreements. And I think that's something the UK should be kind of pushing further and trying to encourage other countries to take those steps as well.
I think one of my favorite examples of countries sticking to the rules is that 72% of global trade is still conducted under World Trade Organization Most Favored Nations. So that's a good sign that 72% of trade is still operating under the rules, despite the fact that they're under incredible pressure. Boram, where did this hyper-partisanship come from?
That's a million-dollar question that I'm not well equipped to answer. But I think there might be two ways to think about it. And first is, you mentioned social media and maybe the perception or maybe ideological leanings that people might have. And another way to think about it is maybe genuinely economic liberalization just drove up economic inequality in those countries like the US and the UK. And some of Stephanie's work actually shows that these economic inequalities tend to elicit authoritarian values, and those value disintegration are magnified by those social media, where people can see other people becoming much wealthier. Some of my college graduates earn much more than I do, which is congratulations. But so that kind of economic inequality is made much more visible through the social media and comparison, and that leads to value like gelation, or I don't know the exact word, but you tend to subscribe to certain values as you tend to compare your economic status in your own society to others who are doing much better than you.
Thanks, Boris. I particularly like that answer. Thank you. All right, questions from the floor, please. Yes, okay. Please introduce yourself and wait for the mic. I'll collect in groups of three, so one here in yellow, one here, and then I'll go here. So one, two, three. Yes, please.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for a lovely deliberation. I am Ashish from India. My question to all of you is, how Global South, led by India, should avoid becoming the economic battleground for the trade war between the United States and China? Thank you.
Thank you. Here, down here, with glasses.
Thank you all very much for some very interesting insights. I'm Benjamin Schmaler. I was a graduate of LSE from last year. My question for you is that a lot of the U.S. administration tend to take a caretaker view towards Europe. They say, well, you know, we're doing this for Europe's own good. I wonder whether any of you can give me some devil's advocate take on whether this might actually happen or not.
Thank you. And then over here in the jacket behind you.
Hi, thanks for these really, really interesting. Bernardo Arce from ODI Global. Very short context, that one of these days we had an event of the UK priorities for the upcoming G20 presidency, and one of the participants said that one area of potential interest is the focus on common lessons from the sectors that have faced imports, competition, and displacement. And my point is that some of these policy challenges may come from constituencies or places that have faced import competition, and the social safety have not covered them. So there have been a lot of linkages of trade and other sectors, but maybe the linkage with social safety nets have not been there for the sectors that have lost from trade. The gains may be given, but the sectors that face these losses are quite evident and politically sensitive. So my question would be your thoughts on how this can be covered, how the benefits of trade can be shown, and how to cover these sectors that may be losing from trade. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Panelists, can I start with Alan? You want to respond? You looked excited.
Well, let me comment on two of them. I mean, I think the question about how the Global South avoids becoming collateral damage is very, very important. And I'm not sure that I have got a solution. Remember that if you're concerned about suffering when the trading system is disrupted, it suggests that you have benefited from trade. And therefore, the answer for the Global South is not in the long run to look inwards and hunker down. Protectionism is not the answer. You're worried about this stuff because you had something and you're worried you're getting it taken away from you. What I do think is that we need to do all that we can to support our international institutions, including so far as the IMF, I'm not sure about the World Bank being up to it, if I'm honest, but the IMF, to emergency loans in cases where this has hit very hard. And then to make sure also that, I suppose, the middle powers don't also slip down the same route as Trump. The middle powers are never going to elevate southern global south's interests above their own, but they might at least
sort of mediate some of the things that they would, might otherwise do. I'm afraid it's a tough answer. I don't think there is a simple answer. And if I can just deal, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name already, about sort of the lessons from sectors facing import competition. It's true, of course, that lots of sectors have faced import competition. And in the past, it hasn't been such an issue. And it's partly because mobility has declined very substantially, and there are various reasons why mobility has declined. But people did used to have to move sectors and move areas, and that is more difficult now. It is also the case that one needs to think about policies, so it's nice to be in the LSE. Henry Overman here, one of your colleagues, is sort of very strong on this. You need to think about supporting people, not supporting sectors. And that does involve helping them perhaps adjust, maybe helping them move. But I don't think we should get into the position of thinking that everyone who ever worked in a threatened, competitive or a declining sector, you know, suffers and suffered indefinitely. I mean, you don't come across firemen from steam engines complaining now about the lack of work. They sort of adjusted. They've mostly retired. You know, the adjustment does happen. And so I think one must be very careful not to start sets of policies that in some sense nail down and make more rigid the system for the sake of supporting people in place, for instance, as opposed to facilitating their being able to move.
Anybody else want to answer? Wayne Bourne? Yeah.
Can I'd like to actually build on what Alan just said about the last question, because I totally agree that people, the policymakers should be thinking about what people want. And that gets me to think about the form of adjustment packages that many governments give out. And for example, the United States Trade Adjustment Assistance, which is basically trying to help people who are laid off because of trade liberalization by giving them some checks or monetary assistance or job upskilling. But then, is that what they really want? And do they really want to take those assistance packages and then they will be okay with liberalization? And one research paper that I recently read by Christoph Pelk, he studied whether people will actually accept a compensation package, like people who worked in the coal mining sector, would they accept this compensation package in return for quitting their job, like to phase out coal? And the key headline from that research is that people would actually rather keep their job despite the compensation package. So that kind of logic cannot be really explained by economics or materialistic perspective, because if you get the same money, why wouldn't you just chill out at home and not work? But then it shows that people actually want to work. They just derive their own rationale for being existence from working. And a lot of how we operate is we derive values from our jobs. And if you take away their jobs because of trade liberalization, and if you want to undo that damage by giving people money instead, that kind of logic does not work for some people. And about mobility, and I mean, as an academic, we are told that we should be able to get a job anywhere in the world. Like that is the mindset that we are told to have when we go to grad school. But then just people who are not an academic, they don't work like that. They don't want to leave their town and they would rather get a job in another sector rather than leaving their state to get a similar job that they used to have. So I think we as a political economy scholars, we need to study much more about what kind of packages or policies actually address what people want.
Thanks.
Yes, I want to come to the second question about, if I understand you correctly, you said, is Trump or is America acting in Europe's interest for Europe's good? And you want to hear answers in support of that view.
I'm saying that
the administration has sort of posited this as a...
Oh, indeed. Okay, all right. I think I can go along with that up to a certain point, because had it not been for American pressure, Europe would have perhaps not gone as far as it has in confronting, for example, China's breaches of certain international trade disciplines. The US is much more keen to dramatize the geopolitical rift, and Europe finds itself much more in the middle position. And that does sometimes smack of lack of strategic thinking and big order thinking. So the US certainly gets credit for bringing to European leaders' attention the need to confront some of the what might be considered hostile action that we find in China's case. But does that mean starting a trade war in the way the US did is in Europe's interest? Clearly not, because Europe is suffering. And the lack of retaliation is interesting, because as Thomas was saying, it's in Europe's interest to maintain a multilateral trading system and engage with China, attract Chinese investment. But that line that will increasingly need to be drawn between what kind of trade and what kind of investment do we want to encourage, and where do we want to draw the line and the boundary, what is strategically important to us in terms of developing domestic capacity, particularly around defense, but also in certain technology sectors, that's where US action has been much more forceful and has perhaps woken up Europeans. But there's one way in which America has clearly helped the Europeans, which is to get their act together and formulate a much more coherent response in that kind of global conflict. So Trump has been a bonus for European integration, there's no doubt about that.
Okay, we'll take another round of questions, please. Okay, so right down here in the front, please. And then we'll come to you, and then we'll go up here. Yeah.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you so much. Hi, my name is Himanshu. I'm from India. Thank you so much for such an insightful discussion. Robert, you were talking about the benefits that US has had, like there is a net increase in their GDP, and I mean their net of good of taxes. Looking to the entire perspective, I think one perspective is that US has gained in terms of collections. They've got their internal industries working, internal environment growing, and politically, as Ms. Borum, you said, they're happy that they linked some issues with that. India or a country like down south, they have gained because there is a shift from China to South Asia, the manufacturing has traveled. With all this, what do you think, like my friend asked, with respect to preparedness, and Professor Allen, you said that there might not be a specific reply to the question, but looking to this entire global geopolitical environment, what do you think, sir? You said that Europe has also gained for that purpose. So when we talk about fracture, so US is gaining, the down South Asian countries are gaining. It might be only China which might be negatively affected, because then there is a straight war. So what globally needs to be the preparedness for countries down south to be there in the business?
Perfect, thank you. We'll go to John here in the front with the green jacket.
Thanks very much. John Cook, an alumnus of LSE from long ago. I'm slightly perplexed by this whole discussion, because it's all about trade in goods, and it begins by being about trade in goods, because of course tariffs hit goods, and we began with tariffs. But nobody has mentioned services at all, which account for over half of the UK's trade. And are we to assume that there's only trade under strain as regards trade in goods, and that services is not strained? or are we to assume that the two are now so separate, which I don't think they are, but we can just argue about goods the whole time? I'd be interested in speakers' views on that.
Thank you. And then up in the back, in the jacket and tie.
Thank you very much. My name is Sebastian Morin, and I'm a distressed trade negotiator. I'm wondering, after this, if we have indeed identified all the causes and are able to answer how we actually go where we actually go from here. In terms of causes, I mean, beyond Trump and the arguably bipartisan adversity to trade in the U.S., I'm wondering if there's not also the rise of China or the decline somehow of the U.S., the U.K., or maybe Europe, after all, which makes it tempting to follow Trump by introducing industrial policies because Europe has missed several technological turns, right? Or raising tariffs in sectors that are suffering, which this country is doing, for example. And yes, most countries are still abiding by the WTO rules, but one, the key one, the most favored nation one, by begging for deals with the US. So how do we get out of this? Are we ready to get back to an economic growth policy following a clear case in economics?
Thank you very much. That question echoes some of the questions coming in online. What is the future of the WTO? Right? Where do we go? And if I may take one more from online, this one is directed exclusively to Robert, but of course anybody can weigh in. This is from Marcella Cavello, a senior research associate at ODI Global. The question is, what are the structural forces driving the international geopolitical policy landscape beyond and after Trump? I'll give you a minute to think about it. We'll start. Alan, you want to start with any responses?
Oh, they're simple ones, aren't they? let me talk about the future of the WTO. I think it's very much in doubt, if I'm perfectly honest. I deeply, deeply regret that. But I think it is quite difficult to see how one is going to restore it. But I wouldn't give up yet. And I do think the most immediate issue is to try and stagger through to 2029 and hope that the US is a little bit more willing to allow, I suppose, basically middle powers to start cobbling together a system. The big problem that we have with Trump is that any attempt to sort of rescue the WTO by a coalition of middle powers will irritate him. And the US, and indeed China also, are large enough and important enough to peel off almost any member of a coalition. It's very difficult to see how you establish a stable coalition in the event, in the face of sort of hostility from Trump or China, who are willing to give bespoke benefits. If I can also just deal very briefly with John's question on services. Look, we don't mention services because Trump doesn't understand them, and we hope, we pray that no one explains to him. There's a lot of truth in that, if I'm honest. But no, we have clearly dangers in services, and Brexit, in a sense, is the illustration of that. Things can be made to go wrong with services trade, and eventually individual governments are going to try and have national policies which aid what they think of as their interests in the service sector. It's also true to say that there are a lot of multinational service companies who are powerful, influential, and probably are sort of whispering in the ears of other governments. Don't mention services, but if you are going to, don't believe that you can sort of do something to help KPMG London, without
You're getting into a huge fight with KPMG all over the country, all over the world.
Thanks. Want to weigh in or?
Yeah, okay. I'd like to. I couldn't really clearly hear your question, the bewildered trade negotiator. But then I'd like to say something about industrial policy. And a lot of people resorted to industrial policy as some sort of solution to this debacles. But I guess what I'm seeing right now is the same chaos or designing problem when it comes to how we can design an industrial policy that can actually last and that can actually have strong political backing from stakeholders. And this is very much an ongoing research, so I'm not saying that I know what's happening in that area, but my co-authors and I are analyzing why some industrial policies are much longer lived than others. And one pattern that we find is that policies that have geopolitical objectives clearly tend to last much longer than policies without geopolitical objectives. Not a surprising finding, like securitization, etc. But then policies with climate objectives tend to be much shorter lived than policies without climate objectives. And here we come back to this question of tribalization that Alan just pointed out. You can just announce as many climate industrial policies as you want, but do you actually have the political backing in your own political basis that can sustain this policy in the long run? And we have seen that IRA just went down despite the Democrats' efforts to design policy-proof and risk-proof the policy. So I think we should think more carefully about what kind of industrial policies and what kind of policy framing we can use to sustain this support that you had in times of designing to a very long-run project.
Thanks. Thomas?
So I just wanted to say something in response to the kind of question about who the kind of winners were from globalization. And I think it's fair to say that if you look at the most recent wave of globalization, I'm thinking here particularly about the period between kind of 1980 and 2016, the countries that most clearly gained from that process were for the most part countries in the global south who benefited not only from exchange of goods and services, but also from exchanging ideas, and in particular from importing and adopting ideas that had been developed abroad. Right? And the most obvious example of that is China, and the way China successfully imitated and adopted foreign technologies and used that to kickstart the industrialization of its own economy. But China is not the only example of that. And I kind of wanted to point to that as an example just to highlight. As John correctly pointed out, we've focused mainly on trade and goods, and we should also think about trade and services. But for welfare consequences, perhaps even more important is trade in ideas and flows of technology across borders. So looking forward, a really important question is going to be if we fragment the global goods trading system, does that mean we also stop exchanging ideas and technologies? Because if we do, the potential costs have become much higher.
Thanks. That's a really important point, because a lot of goods now do contain service components or ideas components. So that's a really important point. So maybe our conversation about goods trade is not completely devoid of conversations about service trade. Robert, I'm going to give you the last word. You got a lot of specific questions there. So the last word is yours.
Thank you. On services trade, we shouldn't forget that the US is actually very much interfering with service trade. It's happening in the digital space, e-commerce, the splintering of the internet. I think that's progressing. Both China and the US are pulling apart in many of these areas. And a lot of services trade depends on people moving, right? Consultants, teachers, doctors, and so on. And what's happening in the US at the moment is leading to a decline in that kind of movement. Anyone who's been to an academic conference in the US recently, I went in March, the attendance went from 5,000 in the previous year to 1,500 this year. That's a big cut in kind of services moving across the boundary. But finally, on what are the bigger forces, Marcello's question online, that are going to determine the future of international politics and trade politics after Trump? I think I need to go back to the point that Alan mentioned at the beginning about Xi Jinping when he welcomed Donald Trump, referring to the Thucydides trap. I thought that was a very subtle and clever way to remind the US president that what Thucydides had in mind, of course, that that analogy has in mind is, of course, that we are dealing with one power that's rising, China in other words, and one power that's declining. That was perhaps too subtle a comment for Trump to take in the meeting, but it certainly is a subtle way for Xi to drive home the message that we are in a state of affairs where the West overall, the US in particular, has been losing global shares of the population, global shares of economic activity, global shares of international trade, and so on and so forth. And that's a long-term trend that is leading to a transformation of the international political economy, the international political system, that's leading to a lot of upheaval, that's eroding trust in the established international institutions that we've built in the past because they were Western-dominated, rising powers want to challenge them. And for that reason, I think whatever happens after Trump, we are still going to have to grapple with a world that will look a lot more diverse, where power is much more dispersed, where values and interests are more diverse too, a kind of pluralistic world, but where it's also therefore much more difficult to create new forms of trust, new forms of institutionalized cooperation. We are going to end up in a much more regionally structured world, and that doesn't bode well for the kind of multilateral trade system that we've had in the past.
Thanks for ending on a positive note.
Oh, yes.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Thank you for your excellent questions, and please join me in thanking our speakers.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.